is First Coast Connect. Good morning, I'm Charles Griggs, sitting in for Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, a conversation with State Representative Angie Nixon. Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, a look at how COVID-19 has impacted healthcare professionals in Florida. But first this hour, debate over increased law enforcement presence around town amidst last weekend's Orange Crest Festival, particularly in Jacksonville beach areas, continues. Some businesses closed and extra law enforcement was brought in to accommodate the situation. Some city leaders and elected officials said the extra precautions were necessary because of a lack of communication with event organizers. Others say the show of force through law enforcement and business closures was unnecessary and racist. The perception of trouble between law enforcement and event goers was so high until some local leaders decided to step in to keep an eye on things. For example, to ensure law enforcement officials were doing their due diligence, Ben Frazier, the leader of the advocacy group Northside Coalition of Jacksonville, said members of his organization and the faith community would be attending some of the Orange Crush events as impartial observers. Frazier said he reached out to State Representative Angie Nixon to support their efforts, and she also expressed concerns. Working together, they received commitments from members of the community to act as impartial observers throughout the event its weekend. For many in the community, the events of last weekend indicate there's still much work to be done dealing with perceptions and building relationships. State Representative Angie Nixon is on the line to discuss her thoughts about the events of last weekend and other issues related to recent policy changes in Florida from the 2021 legislative session. You can join our conversation at 549-2937 or email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can hit me up on Twitter at Charles L. Griggs, or find us on Facebook at WJCT News. Good morning, Representative Nixon.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us this morning. And first, I wanted to get your thoughts. You heard the description as we came into the program. I wanted to get your thoughts since you were participating or at least helped support impartial observers from last weekend's Orange Crush Festival. I wanted to get your thoughts on why do you think that observers were needed? And what does that mean for our community in terms of communication between elected officials and representatives from various areas of the town?
Right. So, unfortunately, as illustrated this past weekend, Jacksonville still has a long way to go in regards to race relations. And actually, more specifically, the state of Florida has really a problem with Black people congregating in public spaces, which is evident by the passage of HB 1, which I like to call Hate Bill 1, which was the anti-protest bill. But unfortunately, that was a racist bill, and some of the things that transpired over this weekend, those folks who, you know, partook in it or did it, closed shops and things like that, said that it had nothing to do with racism or the event goers being Black. It felt very racist. and so it was very upsetting, particularly to my community, many of which the Black community. And so I wanted to ensure that these college students that were coming to town did not have their constitutional or civil rights violated. And so I'm happy to have worked with faith leaders in addition to social justice organizations and some fraternities and sororities to have folks out there to observe, to ensure that folks came and were safe.
Was there any communication between you and faith leaders and other community organizations with law enforcement officials from both communities, from the city of Jacksonville as well as Jacksonville Beach?
So I reached out to the sheriff and let him know that we were, in fact, and as well as the state attorney, to let them know that we were going to have observers out there to ensure, everything was on the up and up. And so I would also like to say the state attorney's office sent someone as well. And so that was great. But there were no issues really. There was a small minor incident, but everything worked out fine. And so, but moving forward, definitely want to have a conversation, a deeper, more intentional conversation with the sheriff's office as it relates to planning or, you know, just coming together and talking in regards to events, particularly when things like this transpire in the media.
Did any of those elected officials or law enforcement officials indicate to you that they were very concerned with problems related to the event itself or individuals who might be attending the event?
So I know that I believe Mr. Frazier and Pastor Gunny may have had more in-depth conversations. I simply kind of just, you know, let Sheriff Williams know what I was doing because the community reached out to me because they were concerned. And I did, in fact, reach out to the organizers and had a few conversations with them about it. They expressed to me that it just seemed like an unwillingness for people to really support what it was that they were doing. I mean, you know, you don't need a permit to have meetups at times at the beach. Like I said, it just seems as though, unfortunately, the state of Florida and Jacksonville has a problem with Black people congregating in public spaces. And that's something that we have to really have a open and honest, uncomfortable conversation around if we want to really heal our state.
Yeah, that was one of the misconceptions or, you know, perceptions about how events like this should be organized. It seems that some of the city leaders from the beaches area as well as in town felt like permits were needed. And what we know is that most of these types of events are just invitations to gather at local spots where permits would not be needed in order to, it would be like inviting people to a restaurant, you know, all come. What needs to be done in order to help communicate, I would say probably some cultural differences as it relates to how communities celebrate or gather or meet up, as you mentioned. What needs to be done in order to help some communities understand and other elected officials understand that that these are terminologies or this is the way maybe young groups see how they entertain themselves today?
Right. They should meet people where they are, right? They should have ongoing conversations year-round with folks within the community. I mean, it was so frustrating this past week, and it's especially since, you know, it was around the Juneteenth holiday, and I was just simply reminded also just why the establishment of American Beach came about, the fact that Blacks were unwelcome on beaches, Jack's Beach, all different types of beaches across the state of Florida. So, you know, A.L. Lewis had to establish a beach for us to go to. And even now, that's being gentrified. And so it's frustrating because we deserve to be in this country. Many of our ancestors helped build this country. And to oftentimes be told to go back where we came from or different things like that, this is literally what people have told me before. It's just ridiculous. And then to seeing on social media things like certain dress codes or, you know, you can't wear a white t-shirt or you can't wear slides into a restaurant, into certain restaurants at the beach. I'm sorry, but that's the beach. Like, that is beach attire. But that was really geared, some of those rules, they seem to be geared at Black people. Like, and I'm going to simply put it out there. It seems to be some racist rules that are happening along the beaches, and it's very unfortunate because Black people spend money. You know, over $1 trillion in this country. Black people spend over $1 trillion in this country, and to be treated like that is just ridiculous.
Have you reached out to your legislative colleague who represents the area to try to have a conversation about events like this, or activities like this, or cultural events like this? I would imagine that the thought process behind this event is not limited to other events, and so mm-hmm. there probably needs to be some type of cultural reckoning across the board. Understanding the need for safety.
I would definitely be open to a conversation. Have I reached out yet? No. As you know, I just had a big event myself, my wedding this past weekend. But I would definitely be open to having a conversation. Thank you. I would definitely be open to a conversation around it. Do I think that they would be as open? I am not sure, because my colleagues that represent those areas voted for HB1. Which was the anti-protest bill. And so that bill was really a hate bill that is a clear response. It was a clear response after the peaceful protest that happened last year around the Black Lives Matter movement. Yes, Governor DeSantis and many of my colleagues, my Republican colleagues, got up and said that it was in response to the insurrection. However, they didn't denounce the insurrection, right? And so it really, and then also we know that that bill was drafted back in October. The insurrection didn't happen until January. And so again, as I stated earlier, the state of Florida seemingly has a problem with Black people congregating in public spaces. And it's very upsetting being a Black woman, feeling as though this country, this state, this city acts as though Black people are inherently bad, and that's not the case, especially Black people that look a certain way. You know, I have natural hair. I'm treated differently until people realize that I'm a state representative, you know, and why is that? I should be able to rock my hair the way in which I want to wear it. I should be able to wear whatever I want to wear. You know, I pay taxes and everything. And so I can only imagine what other people who don't have this title have to go through.
Okay. We do have a call on the line. Mark from the West Side. Good morning, Mark. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Yes, good morning. I'm not seeing why the sheriff's office and city officials, I guess, making adequate preparations and just trying to plan ahead in light of, you know, this festival was thrown out of Tybee Island, and in light of the festival organizers seem to not want to talk to anybody about this thing, why is it necessarily racist for the sheriff's office and people to make preparations for a big 20,000 crowd of young people? I mean, it's, you know, one of the reasons, you know, little activity was the weather was bad and they didn't get as many people there as they anticipated. But what if it had been the opposite and there had been 20,000 people there and horrible things had happened, and then you'd be jumping on them about not being or something? I just don't get why it's considered racist. It's just good, proper city planning.
Thank you for that, Mark. That has been one of the common pushbacks around this let's say, heavy law enforcement presence, is that there were a lot of unknowns. Festival organizers did not do a good job of communicating. They did not really work well with city officials in both cities. And so this was really the law enforcement trying to be prepared for the unknown. And mm-hmm. there may not have been any racial aspect to it at all.
So I would definitely, I want to push back against that narrative. And I know that, you know, First Coast News did an interview with the mayor of Tybee Island, and she stated that we didn't have anything to worry about, and that only thing we should worry about is things like maybe, you know, traffic or crowd control, as well as trash. And, you know, as a graduate of the University of Florida, and coming from the era of don't tase me, bro, right, I know things, people, I know the way in which this event was treated as opposed to the largest outdoor cocktail party that transpires and takes place usually every year here. It's totally different. And you know, when I went to the University of Florida, we won multiple championships on football and basketball, and my classmates acted a donkey, some would say, you know, climbing light poles, jumping on cars, destroying property and things like that. But a lot of those kids got, you know, slaps on the wrist. There weren't talks about ensuring that there's adequate spaces in jail for them. But when Black kids converge into an area, we have to talk about how we have to increase the police presence. And that in of itself, that has racial undertones. And so I've never seen anything like this as it relates to that, as it relates to planning, you know. And if you had an issue with the organizers, I get it. But to go about and to say to the media, like, we're having conversations about making sure that there's enough jail space, like, really? So you're saying that Black people don't know how to get together without rioting or without destroying property? And I'm going to push back on that because I'm one of the co-organizers of the Melanin Market, which is in its fifth season. We hold a quarterly event. We recently, this past Saturday, had over 200 vendors, in which we had thousands of event goers. We have never had an incident with crime or with anyone acting out at all. So to come across the way in which it did this past weekend in response to Orange Crush was just really upsetting, and it really shows again that we have some racial issues that we need to address here in our city. And it's even more evident if you go into the social media pages where they publish these, you know, the news social media pages where they publish these articles about Orange Crush, and you see the responses by people who live here in this city as it relates to Black kids coming to town, wanting to have a good time, predominantly white kids go in Panama City Beach and do the exact same thing.
Okay.
With very little organizing and, you know, conversing with city officials over there.
Okay, we're going to try to get a few calls in. Stanley is on the north side. Stanley, good morning.
Yes, how you doing today?
Thank you.
People know that I am in my community and also all over this country. I have never opposed Ms. Nix. She is doing a great job. I am appalled by this city continue with that racism in this city. The elected officials are African-American, regardless of race, should engage this event just like they do every other event. And I've been in the entertainment business for 40 years, also in civil rights. I have never in my life seen an event take place where you hold a group of people, African-American, responsible for creating crime. That's that racist element of Jacksonville that won't die. And until we address that, nothing's going to change. And kiss the baby for me, Angela.
Thank you for that, Stanley. Appreciate it. We have another caller. Aaron is on the line. Thank you for joining us this morning, Aaron.
Good morning. Thank you. How are you?
Great.
Great. I just wanted to comment. One of the gentlemen called in just a few minutes ago and just kind of expressed that he didn't understand why there was such a problem with the police clearing the jails just in case. And I think another perspective to kind of lend to that, especially for those not in the African-American community, is I think with the same willingness that a lot of the country was willing to embrace the liberal media and the lies that they told and things weren't true that was reported by the liberal media, especially around things with Donald Trump, need to realize that that same thing is probably happening with African Americans. We hear from the media or we hear on the news that there was such an issue in Tybee Island and things like that, but I think what we don't realize is that what we're hearing may be just as slanted as what the Republicans often thought the liberal media slanted the news with other things. So I think a lot of times when we're hearing this stuff on social media or we're hearing this stuff on the news, we take it as the truth, and often I think that is not the case. Like Representative Nixon said, the mayor in Tybee Island said the only thing that we really had to worry about was traffic congestion and things like that. So that clearly expressed that she didn't feel there was necessarily a violence or an element that maybe would warrant clearing the jails. But again, people here that are threatened here, it got moved from Tybee Island, so the immediate thought is that there's danger, there's a presence there. And I think that people need to be as open-minded about the media slant for African-American issues as they are with Republican and Democrat issues.
Right. Thank you for that, Aaron.
That's my comment.
I appreciate it. Thank you for joining us this morning, too, as well. There definitely was information coming out of Tybee Island, the previous events that occurred in Tybee Island, that allowed for perceptions to be drawn about what to anticipate here. And again, elected officials and law enforcement felt like that was the only information they had to go on. Early information about, you know, the behavior and arrests from previous events, and they wanted to be prepared for that. We've talked about, what perhaps needs to happen, more conversation on, how the community could do better with dealing with large-scale events related to the African-American community and culture. We're going to try to take one more call before we let Representative Nixon go. Dale is on the line from Ortega. Good morning, Dale.
Good morning. I'd like to add something else to this. I think that we as blacks, I'm a black business owner in this city. I've lived here my entire life. I understand the racial undertones that happen here all too well. I think that we as African Americans, blacks, however you want to call it, should also keep in mind the way that we spend our dollars. Because even if they don't like us because of the color of our skin, even if they don't like our children, our money is green. And we should go places and spend our money in places that we are welcome, not in places where we're going to be put on display as far as being hooligans and thugs and whatnot. I also think that, I heard the one caller say, what's the harm in that? I didn't hear any of that preparation when it was the Welcome to Rockville or, as your guest stated, the largest outdoor cocktail party where they have hundreds of incidents of violence and mayhem going on at any of those festivals or concerts or whatever you want to call them, the game, the big football game or whatever. You just don't find those types of, they don't put that out there. I also think that a lot of the publicity that went around that was to deter people from coming to a festival that was going to bring people that were spending money. Money and money to the tax base and the tax coffers of this city.
Okay.
And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Dale. Representative?
I would echo those same statements. I don't spend my money where I'm not wanted. And I don't spend my money where my community isn't wanted. And so I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Well, thank you, State Representative Angie Nixon, for joining us this morning on First Coast Connect. We appreciate your time and your comments, and we look forward to talking with you again soon.
Definitely. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Later in the hour, a new treatment for Alzheimer's disease. But up next, an update on Marsha's efforts to move across the river. Welcome back. The city's Museum of Science and History is working to move across the river. The Mosh, which sits downtown on the South Bank, is raising millions to build an upgraded new facility on the other side of the St. Johns River on the North Bank. Melissa Ross learned more about the Mosh's Genesis campaign and when she spoke with CEO Bruce Fairford.
Hey, Bruce. Good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. Always a pleasure.
Big plans over at the Mosh, the Museum of Science and History, as you work on this big campaign to raise enough to build a new facility on the North Bank, across the river from where you are now on the South Bank. Tell us a little bit more about the Mosh Genesis campaign and where you're at with it.
So we have made a substantial amount of progress. We are currently just past the $31 million mark in our capital campaign. We continue to get a considerable amount of interest from private donors, community leaders, businesses. There is not a week that has gone by that I haven't made a presentation or someone in our development team has not gone out and made a presentation. And the response that we get has been overwhelmingly positive. The community is very excited about what the potential is and building a brand new museum for this community on the North Bank. The other update that we're tremendously excited about, we just finished a week-long series of interviews with the final three architects. They were all here on site at the Mosh, and they presented their thoughts and ideas and some of their very conceptual plans. Now we're going through the process of evaluating what they presented. They've also provided written responses to the RFP that we issued late in March, and we continue to move in that direction. Our goal is to bring that to the Board of Trustees at the end of June and make a final decision shortly after that. So we have a lot of momentum.
That's great. And so the vision that you have for the Mosh on the North Bank is really exciting, the images that we've seen. Why the move to the North Bank, and what will the expansion, the new facility, look like? It looks like a big upgrade from, not to denigrate what the Mosh is now, but a big upgrade from where you are now.
So the decision to move to the North Bank included fairly in-depth analysis by the Board of Trustees, looking at a variety of different issues that we would have faced if we stayed here. One of them would have had a devastating impact operationally. We would have had to close this facility for 2 years in order to accomplish a complete top-to-bottom renovation. And as a nonprofit museum, that really was not financially viable. We also would have had to displace all our collections, all our animals, and logistically, that in and of itself would have been very difficult to overcome. The other item that the board spent considerable time discussing and looking into is the whole concept of resiliency. This building it was built in the mid-60s, late 60s, and there is really very little room for us to build resiliency into this structure. Moving to the North Bank not only will allow us to incorporate current design elements that will support resiliency, but also having brand new 130,000 square foot museum gives us the capability to lay out the museum in a much more visitor-friendly way, to engage our visitors, to draw them into the learning that we engage in here. And so it really is going to make a huge difference. It also lets us expand the programs that we have and tie these programs together so that they're not isolated in a separate wing or in a separate galley, that they actually overlap and interact with each other. So those are some of the benefits that we'll get moving to the North Bank. In addition, being right adjacent to the sports and entertainment district really has the ability to complement what we're doing. A family can come and spend a half a day at Mosh and maybe go take in a jumbo shrimp game or one of the other venues in that area, or the reverse. Maybe they go to a jumbo shrimp game and then come up and see us later. So there's a lot of adjacencies there.
Yeah. Now, of course, this is several years away before we see this new building open. In the meantime, the Mosh is open and you have a lot going on this summer, including summer camps, right?
Yes. Yes, we do. We have as of this past Tuesday, we have over 100 school groups, summer camp groups, already reserved for the summer. So the demand is very high. We still have a little more room in our own summer camps. And so if anyone is interested, please get on our website at www.themosh.org. Sign your kid up. We have a wonderful program laid out for this summer. We also have a brand new exhibit that we just brought in. And the excitement around the Lost World of Dragons, It is a fantastic exhibit. In fact, it even contains a challenge. As you walk through and interact, there's a series of learning stations that you go through. You learn about the history of the dragon, what culture it came from, how it got incorporated into that culture, what are the foundations of it, and then there are questions that you need to answer, and at the end there's actually a little bit of a reward along with that, and we also have a augmented reality component to it.
Sounds fun. You know, my kids did camp at the Mosh, and when they were younger especially, we spent a lot of great hours visiting so many different exhibits. So check it out, everybody, themosh.org on the South Bank, but that's not forever. They will eventually be on the other side of the river. CEO Bruce Fafard of the Museum of Science and History. Bruce, great to hear about all of the forward momentum, and we'll follow along. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa. I really do appreciate it.
Welcome back. A team of University of North Florida researchers within the Brooks College of Health have published results of a study that looked at how COVID-19 impacted healthcare professionals in Florida. One of those researchers, Dr. Kristen Roof, a UNF nutrition and dietetics assistant professor, is on the line now with the results. Good morning, Kristen. Dr. Roof.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on today.
Thank you very much. This is very interesting because we know that healthcare professionals have been on the front line during COVID-19. And one of the things that we've all been curious about is, you know, how are they faring? They're the ones who are really sort of fending the battle for the community. What has your research told you about healthcare professionals and short and long-term impacts?
Yeah, so we conducted this study to capture information to really see what the landscape looked like for the healthcare professionals within the first 4 months. So this was exciting that we really captured it early. We looked at how it impacted their employment, their telehealth usage, and then the interprofessional collaboration. And so we found that it was really uniquely different per profession, which is something that we weren't expecting. So, for example, the rehabilitation providers were more likely to be furloughed as compared to, let's say, your primary care or your nurses. So that was really interesting finding. And then we also saw a huge transition to telehealth, you know, as healthcare was really undergoing a surge with COVID. We also saw a lot of facilities having less in-person interaction and trying to use telehealth. So those are really interesting findings and how the healthcare professionals really adapted with that transition and what they felt about that transition.
Does your any research tell you how the telehealth transition impacted some of the private practices?
Yes. Yeah, so we didn't look specifically at the different areas of practice because there's so many different areas. We surveyed, you know, physicians, nurses, registered dietitians, and several different types of therapy personnel. So we did find that the telehealth usage, they had very little telehealth training in general. And so while they were, you know, requested to provide this telehealth services, most of them weren't exactly sure how best to do that due to the lack of training, but they were still providing these services. So that is a good thing that they were able to really pivot gears and adapt. But we know that now and moving forward, we need increased education and increased training on how not only to use these telehealth platforms, but also how to make sure we still have that interprofessional collaboration. So rather than, you know, going and seeing every healthcare profession as a silo, over the past decade, healthcare has done a really good job at making sure that we're working together as a healthcare team to ultimately provide the best care for all of our, you know, patients and the Florida residents. And so one of the things that we found in our study was that interprofessional collaboration, not only the amount of interactions, but also the satisfaction of the interactions was both down compared to pre-pandemic. So we really hope that, you know, future education and training and policies around telehealth will allow not only to continue to provide telehealth services, but also being able to maximize these interprofessional opportunities to help with patient care too and patient satisfaction.
Yeah, so telehealth is one of the large, one of the major transitions that providers had to adopt during the pandemic. What do you think, or what do you see? What will all these transitions do to the industry itself? What type of changes do you see for the long term as a result of the impacts that have occurred during the pandemic?
Yeah, you know, that's really a great question. Pre-pandemic, there were a lot of policies around, you know, regulatory and reimbursement when it comes to telehealth, which is why a lot of healthcare providers in general never provided telehealth services. And so with the pandemic, it's eased a lot of the restrictions, which has allowed these healthcare professionals, such as registered dietitians and physical therapists and, you know, licensed mental health counselors to be providing these services without those, you know, red tape regulatory restrictions. And so since there was temporary removal of a lot of those restrictions, I think we're going to see more of a permanent removal or more of a increased expansion to allow an array of healthcare providers to perform these telehealth services and ultimately to get reimbursed. Because if, you know, if providers cannot get reimbursed for telehealth, then they're less likely to use it. And really it's a win-win, right? Who wouldn't love, you know, as a patient to see a healthcare professional from across the disciplines from your own living room? You know, it's a win-win for the providers and also the patient. So I think we're seeing that telehealth is still being provided. And I think as long as the restrictions remain limited, that can help just healthcare as a whole to make sure that we are providing different types of healthcare delivery. You know, you're never going to get rid of the in-person healthcare providers. But if we can also reach people with telehealth platforms, that would be great, especially for those who are living in rural areas or who have limited time or access to going to healthcare facilities. Mm-hmm. So I'm positive. I think as a healthcare professional myself, I'm a registered dietitian. I think this is a huge win as far as being able to provide the services, and I hope that insurance and reimbursement and regulatory restrictions remain limited.
Yeah, so according to your study, some of these providers are probably frustrated at a lot of the transitions that they had to make. But by and large, do you think that, over time they will see some of these transitions as efficiencies or, maybe opportunities to expand on healthcare itself?
I think it really depends on the discipline of the healthcare professionals. You know, some healthcare professionals conduct more regular, you know, physical assessments and things which are potentially better with a face-to-face in-person interaction, whereas some healthcare professionals, such as, you know, your licensed mental health counselors, maybe social workers or physicians, might be able to see people via these telehealth platforms. So I think it's really discipline-specific, and that's what we saw a lot in our study, even though our study was really just to describe the landscape and what was happening then. I think that it will continue to have multiple modes of delivery in healthcare, really discipline specific. But I do think that COVID and what we have found is, since there was such a need for telehealth and telehealth usage, even though that the current healthcare professionals were not the most trained on delivering telehealth, I think it brings forth a lot of opportunity for different hospitals or private practices to continue to train their healthcare providers on delivering telehealth, because I think it could be an avenue to, you know, increase exposure of the clinic, but also to increase accessibility for the patients and for Florida residents.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just a little, one of the things I want to kind of get to before we get out of here is that the customer service, you know, what are the, on the provider standpoint, you know, they're having challenges, but what type of impact this has on the quality of care, and how are people on the other end receiving that?
I think that's a good question. I think that's something that still needs to be conducted, is looking at the patient end and seeing how they're liking it. We saw from our study, when we looked, we deployed a telehealth usability questionnaire to really get their perspectives on that telehealth platform. And so that's actually another paper that should be coming out in the coming months.
Okay.
But I think on the patient end, there could be pros and cons, right? It depends on accessibility, internet demands. Do they have the capabilities to be accessing these services? But also, are they still getting care without distractions? You know, a lot of children are home, so can a patient really get the care that they need if they're also trying to tend to individuals that they're their primary caregiver?
Okay.
So I think some disciplines will lend a positive to certain patients.
Okay.
And
okay.
Some maybe not so
much. Thank you for that, Dr. Roof. I hate to cut you off, but we have run out a little bit of time. Now, we appreciate you, your thoughts and the study, and we look forward to more information in the future.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
Florida Polytechnic University, ranked among the top 40 public universities for best undergraduate engineering colleges by U.S. News & World Report, and the only Florida university in this category. More information is available at floridapoly.edu. St. Augustine's Fort Mose Historical Society celebrates the reenactment of the Battle of Bloody Mose on June 26th. Fort Mose is the site of the first legal free black settlement in North America. More at historiccoastculture.com.
I'm Marco Werman. The World's Newsroom brings you the big picture stories and some other stuff.
Dear sir, I like words. I like fat, buttery words such as ooze, turpitude, gluttonous, toady. I like spurious, black is white words such as mortician, liquidate, tonsorial.
Join us and hear the world.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Renee Elise Goldsberry. She was one of the stars of the original Broadway production of Hamilton and won a Tony for her performance as Angelica Schuyler. Now she's a star of the new comedy series Girls 5 Eva, about the members of a 90s girl group who reunite when the women are middle-aged. Tina Fey is one of the executive producers. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
America's public health officials have faced a crisis like no other. For 18 months, they've pleaded with the public to trust the science that saves lives.
If this data doesn't compel you to act, then all I have left is to set my hair on fire.
But only now are they starting to reflect on how far we've come. Some of those who've been on the front line join us next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. The FDA recently approved a new drug to treat Alzheimer's disease. It's the first time in decades a new treatment for Alzheimer's has come onto the market. But this experimental medication, Aduhelm, has its critics. Melissa Ross spoke with Dr. Raju Parikh, neurologist at Memorial Hospital.
Hi, Dr. Parikh. Thanks for joining us. Good to talk to you.
Same here. How are you, Melissa?
I'm well, and I'm curious to get your thoughts about this new experimental drug for Alzheimer's patients. It's been a long time since anything like this went through the approval process. What are your thoughts about Aduhelm and the promise? Some say it's showing in slowing progression of the disease.
Yeah, so as you said, you know, it's been a while that we have something for the Alzheimer's itself. I think the last approval of a medication for Alzheimer's came in was in 2003, and there were multiple studies in between that tried to find a new drug, and a lot of them did not succeed. And Aduhelm actually, so what they have done is they're trying to target the amyloid plaque, which is the main issue with Alzheimer's. And they came up with the two studies, and one study showed some benefit and some improvement or slowing the disease progression itself. And the other study did not show any clear benefit. So there was this kind of conflicting data. And that kind of caused this stir-up where there are a lot of special or expert people in the medical field are questioning about whether this drug is really helpful or not. But I think overall, to look at it, I mean, there is something new after so long. We really needed something for the disease like Alzheimer's, and we'll have to see if this is going to be a major helpful drug for the Alzheimer's itself or not. And I think they're going to continue to look at the data as we continue to use this and see how effective is this.
So still waiting to see the full array of patient response. It's an expensive drug too. Will you be prescribing it to your patients at Memorial Hospital in Jacksonville?
Yes. It is FDA approved, so
yeah.
I think we will be definitely screening the patient and trying to find the right fit. There are different criteria, and they have to go through different testing before they get prescribed this medication. But definitely we are working on, and we will be prescribing the medication for the right patients for this.
Isn't it most commonly recommended for people in the earlier phases of the disease? Is that right?
That's correct. So it's for the patients who has mild cognitive impairment, which is like a pre-dementia or early stages of the Alzheimer's. And that's when basically we start the infusion of the drug. And what they studied in the trials where they continued the infusion at least for 18 months and saw that there was a slowing of the decline or slowing of the progression of the disease overall.
Mm-hmm. What can you tell people that are, you know, they're getting up in years, or maybe even some younger patients might be worried that they are seeing the first signs of Alzheimer's disease? The symptoms are something that we've talked about before on this program. There's a difference between being occasionally forgetful and having Alzheimer's. Can you explain what some of the signs and symptoms are?
Sure. So I think the most common age that we start seeing Alzheimer's that comes up is generally after 65 and more after 70, I would say. It's very uncommon, really, really uncommon for people below the age of 65. Now, if you're having just simple, forgetting simple things, like you are going into the kitchen and don't remember, okay, why did I come to here to get what? Or you forgot where did you put your keys, or you don't know what did you do yesterday and you're trying to figure out, and then you get it after a few minutes. I mean, that's generally not worried about. I mean, once in a while, those things, everyone goes through that. It's something, I think, it's more where you're forgetting and you're not worried about it, or you're forgetting and your family comes and says, hey, you forget this. Do you remember where did you put that? And you don't even have any clue about it. So it's like something more that other family member picks it up, and also which is something more progressive where you're seeing the changes that is more and more frequent, or it's kind of progressing over the time. But once in a while, forgetting things here and there, I would not much worry about those kind of issues.
Not worry so much about that. But if someone is dealing with Alzheimer's disease, they should at least inquire about Aduhelm as a potential treatment, right?
That's correct, yes, for sure. I think, if you're having, if you're in more than 65 or 70, and if you're having frequent trouble with short-term memory or family is worried about it, yes, the first thing will be to talk to your doctor. They can run a quick memory test in their office, which is the initial screening test we do. And if there is something looks like Alzheimer's, yes, definitely that's early stages is the time where to try this and ask about it. Yes, definitely, I think something they should inquire about.
Thank you so much. He's Dr. Rajul Parikh, neurologist with Memorial Hospital. Thanks, doctor.
Thank you, Melissa.
And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Thank you, Josh. Our editorial director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Have questions or comments about First Coast Connect? Send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Charles Griggs, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow, but if you missed anything, you can listen to the replay on wjct.org and on your favorite podcast platform. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.